Your personal info, like addresses, phone numbers, and more, are collected and sold by data brokers. But Aura steps in, scanning the web, sending you alerts, and requesting your info be removed. Get Aura's full toolkit, including credit and transaction monitoring, a password manager, VPN, and more. Get a 14-day free trial at aura.com/safety. That's aura.com/safety.
Rising sea levels, extreme weather patterns, extinctions of species. Our planet needs protecting. I'm Adam Vaughan, the environment editor for The Times, and this is Planet Hope from The Times, in partnership with Rolex and its Perpetual Planet Initiative. In this podcast, we hear from leading experts from around the world who are committed to finding solutions. These explorers, scientists, entrepreneurs, and citizens are committed to a common goal: to protect our home, Earth. Listen now wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, this is the Red Box Podcast. I'm Matt Chorley, bringing you the best of my Times radio show. You can listen live Monday to Friday, 10 till 1, on your DAB radio, on your smart speaker, or download the Times radio app, new and improved Times radio app, no less, so you can listen to us if you're out and about. Just a reminder that at the end of this week, we are opening the doors to the Museum of Political Fiascos, all prompted by Danny Finkelstein. Earlier in the week, he suggested that Liz Truss's lectern should go in a museum. So we open the doors to the Museum of Political Fiascos. If you've got a suggestion for what should be in it, is it a lectern? Is it a bacon sandwich? Is it John Major's soapbox? You can email me, matt@times.radio, matt@times.radio, and you can join the team of curators. That'll be on the podcast tomorrow. Right, coming up today, it's the monthly Times Radio Focus Group. A panel of undecided voters deliver their verdict on Keir Starmer, Rishi Sunak, and sweary Gillian Keegan. That's coming up in just a moment. But first, let's take a wade through the news with today's columnist panel.
Manveen Rana and someone called Matthew on Times Radio.
Hello, Manveen Rana.
Hello.
And to Matthew Bell. Good morning.
Good morning.
Good to have you both here. Now, Rishi Sunak is off on his travels. I assume he's not going by helicopter. I think I'm not sure it would get him all the way to India. But he's off to the G20 summit in India later today. Amrit Dhillon's reporter for The Times, based in India. And I asked her to just sum up for us the state of relations between the UK and India.
Well, as of now, I'd say the relations are pretty good. I mean, the FTA, of course, is taking a long time, but that was natural because there are so many complex, contentious issues. But as far as I can tell, relations are good. There are no friction points. Modi has described India's relationship with the UK as a living bridge between the two countries. And on Britain's side, I mean, for Mr. Sunak, India is very important because of its population, which has overtaken China's. India's is the fifth largest economy, which offers a huge market for British goods. And India is a useful counterweight to China. Now, internationally, human rights organizations have over the years wrapped the Indian government on the knuckles for alleged human rights violations, for suppression of certain freedoms, and for the treatment of the country's minorities. But the difference is that no Western leader, including Mr. Sunak, has thought it fit to reprimand Mr. Modi on these matters. So I don't see any major friction points, except, of course, the issues in the trade talks, which need to be ironed out.
So, Manveen and Matthew, I wanted to sort of talk about sort of Britain's place in the world. It seems like there's obviously lots going on domestically, but the two big things, I suppose, happening this week, Manveen. Britain rejoining the Horizon Science Programme, cooperating with the EU, having left it so stroppily after voting for Brexit. And then Rishi Sunak going to India to this summit, this G20 summit, and sort of trying to find Britain's and his place in the world.
Yeah, and I don't think this is a new thing. If you remember, Theresa May, one of her first visits was to India, and it was just after Brexit, and I think she sort of thought this would be an easy trade deal to be able to say, here's global Britain, we're back on the scene, where, leaving Europe hasn't affected us at all. Here we are sort of showing the biggest trade relationships with the big sort of rising emerging economies. And it didn't work. You know, she turned up and I remember speaking to sort of some of the people who went with her who sort of said, you know, I think they sort of had a slightly colonial, old-fashioned view of India where it was like, well, we have these very old links and when we get there, they'll all welcome us in. And actually they sort of said, well, why would we need a trade deal with you? And I think it was probably sort of a moment for the government to sort of realise that in the new world, what do we actually have to offer? And, you know, this trade deal ever since then has been on hold. And it's mainly because we haven't been able to agree on whether we should allow more Indian students in and more working visas for Indian citizens to come over and work in Britain. I think we'll probably have to end up giving way on that. But, you know, that's a discussion that we've never really sort of had. You know, politicians never have with the public, you know, given that so much of the Brexit vote was against more people being able to come to Britain to work. You know, I don't know how well that's going to go down. But we're sort of in a position where if we want these trade deals, we have a very weakened hand. And, you know, India is part of the BRICS, these great rising economies who are sort of creating their own world order, really. You know, I think that the only thing that really unites them, so this is a group that started off because they were the big rising economies. Many of them have floundered. You know, if you look at South Africa, which is one of them, they're in the economic doldrums. But they had this big meeting a couple of weeks ago in South Africa, and they're now extending the group. And the only thing that really unites them, this is, you know, it's a group that includes Saudi Arabia and Iran, who are sworn enemies. India and China, to be honest, are still on a war footing in many places. The only thing that unites them is the desire to show the West that the world has changed and they're now far more powerful than they were in the past. And I think that, you know, for governments in the West is a real alarm bell. We should be taking note and working out how we can have trade relations and how we don't end up alienating the rest of the world. And, you know, whether there is a way of, for example, having relations with India and you know, therefore getting away with, you know, had slight difficulties with China. You know, it's just working out your new alliances. And I don't think we're forward looking enough to be doing that right now.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of this visit is going to come down to Sunak's personal relations with India. And I'm not sure that that's really a sustainable way for a government to go forward. It depends on him being number 10.
It's interesting that. And actually, Matthew, this morning, the High Commissioner for India, who's based in the UK, Sri Vikram Doraiswamy, was on Times Radio and talking about this. You know, they want to get a free trade deal because there's a lot of businesses which invest, British businesses which invest in India and vice versa. But actually was quite adamant that they weren't looking for visas. They weren't looking for higher numbers of people to migrate to Britain from India. What they wanted was to make it easier for people to move between those two, between the two countries. Inter-company transfers was the big thing. And actually, I suppose that's like proper grown-up, nuanced political discussion as part of a trade agreement, rather than the slightly more simplistic view of people coming to Britain equals bad.
Well, exactly. And I'd have to say, I do feel a little bit sorry for Rishi Sunak, because it seems this trade deal has been going on for nearly 2 years. I think this is the 13th or 12th round of talks they've had. And this sticking point does seem to be the issue of visas, which is the great irony, of course, which is if we can get this trade deal through, then this will really make the Brexit project take off finally, because it's going to be a very valuable arrangement. However, the sticking point is the free movement of people, which is the one thing you can't tell Brexit supporters you're giving. So he's really got to try and make it work. I don't know if he will, though. There are 20 countries, more than 20 countries present. And my interpretation of these events is it's everyone's going in there trying to get their own agenda dealt with. And in the case of Modi, you know, he's positioning himself now as a global statesman and using the G20 very much as an opportunity to set out his stall as India, rightly so, as, you know, one of the largest economies in the world. Is he going to have time to listen to Minnow Rishi Sunak coming up to him? I don't think so. But I think they're meeting again in the autumn to thrash it out. But it would be fantastic, as you say, if Rishi could be open to a more nuanced type of agreement, whereby there could be a bit of flexibility in the movement. But, you know, he's got to come back to the House of Parliament and to the far right of the Conservative Party and say, look, I've got the trade deal over the line, but it does mean a bit of nuance. And I don't think nuance goes down very well with the far right of the Conservative Party.
Yeah, and actually, it was an interesting question as well around whether or not Rishi Sunak's Indian heritage, obviously his father-in-law is the billionaire Indian businessman as well, whether or not that will, you know, that, you know, politics ultimately is about people, and that might get him an in, and actually is a basis for starting some of those talks in a slightly more, I don't know, cooperative, collegiate way, rather than the standoffs that we've maybe seen in the past. Well, we'll see how he gets on as he heads to the G20. We'll also keep across that. Let's come from the G20 in India. Let's come straight back to the South Cambridgeshire District Council. It has been pioneering giving staff a four-day working week. So, you know, like the bin men, if they could collect all the bins in 4 days, so same number of bins being collected by the same number of people, you do it in 4 days and you get a three-day weekend. But the government doesn't like the idea, and it's written again to tell them to stop it. Here is Rishi Sunak talking about it in the Commons.
Public servants should rightly focus on delivering for the public and taxpayers. And it is disappointing to hear from my honourable friend that his local Liberal Democrat council is not doing this, reducing, as I heard, staff contact hours and costing residents more. I urge the council to reconsider their decision because his residents and constituents in South Cambridgeshire District Council clearly deserve better.
Clearly deserve better. But this is employees getting 100% of their workload done in 80% of the time for 100% of the pay. It's a Lib Dem run council, so that may well be playing into it. The local government minister, Lee Rowley, has written to them again yesterday, telling the council to stop it. Matthew, what do you think about this? Because it can cut both ways. On the one hand, you know, if it gets the work done and you can retain staff, then that must be good. But on the other hand, if they can get all of their work done in 80% of the time, maybe they weren't doing enough work in the first place.
Well, there's a word for this, and it's called efficiency. They're just getting the job done in less time. And that's all people want to do. That's what you're asking of your employees, is to be as efficient as possible. So I'm all for the four-day week. You know, Alain de Botton wrote a very good book about this, analysing how people work. And he saw that these companies in the city that expect their employees to come in very early and stay all night, work till late, doing these big deals, their efficiency actually went down over time because you can't be expected to work 20 hours a day. And so if the council in South Cambridgeshire is managing to find a way of cramming all their work into 4 days, then they will benefit long term from having a 3 day weekend. You know, the 5-2 ratio of the working week is, I think, needs to be changed actually for more people, because there's so much personal life admin you need to get done. You know, you end up doing at your desk at work. So your efficiency when you're at work goes down if you're having to turn up 9 to 5 Monday to Friday. Whereas if you're given a day off to go and, you know, do your Christmas shopping or whatever it is, I think actually the rewards are for the employers.
What do you think, Manveen? Because some employers might think, particularly the private sector, might think, well, if you can get the work done, you can pay for 4 days' work.
Well, I don't know. Like Matthew, I am a fan of the idea of a 4 day working week. Places where they've made it work, I mean, there are lots of studies into this that sort of say, as Matthew said, you know, it leads to greater efficiencies, it makes people more productive when they are at work. You know, they're less tired, they're much more committed. The places where it has worked across the continent, you know, places like Belgium and Portugal, I think, they've had a model which they sort of call the 180-100 model, which means that you're being paid 100% of what you were paid before. You're still being paid exactly the same wages. You're spending 80% of your time that you were spending before working, but you're still 100% in terms of productivity too. So the deal should be you still get paid what you were before, but you've got to show that you're being just as productive. What I can't figure out with this council, because, you know, in many ways, I think this is probably the future, and well done them for recognising that and moving towards it. But there seem to be lots of problems. Their productivity definitely seems to have fallen. They're not answering calls efficiently. I couldn't understand what's happening with the bin men. The bin men are going down to 4 days, but you'd sort of think, well, don't they just rework the rotor a bit to make sure bins are still being collected every week? It feels like maybe they're just doing it wrong. I think for a 4 day week can be hugely successful. Maybe they just haven't figured out how to make it work, you know, just rotoring people on different shifts or making sure that the round, you know, the bin collection round is sort of divided up into a 4 day system instead. I just feel like that these are surmountable problems.
I suppose the thing is,
I can't understand why they're not working.
I can understand the bins because there are, you know, you have a number of bins that need to be collected, and you can tell at the end of the 4 days whether or not they've all been collected. Have you done 100% of the bins in 80% of the days? If you are a, I don't know, planning officer who's got to just work through a never-ending supply of planning applications, or someone working on policy, or something with a less definable thing, how can you know that someone's doing 100% of the work and 80% of the time?
Well, those are the people that will actually suffer if they end up working a four-day week, because you end up doing your, you know, allegedly you're off on a Friday, but you end up having to do more work to catch up by the Monday. I mean, I remember I had a 3 day a week job on a magazine, which sounded like the dream job. But actually, you end up working on the other days because everyone else is in 5 days a week. So they're still emailing on a Monday and a Friday. And so it's those jobs where there's a never ending amount of work that it doesn't work. You've got to have fixed times, and you go in, you do as much as you can, you get out again. Same with a GP. You know, if he's got 200 telephone calls waiting, he can't be expected to sit there and work through them all. He's got to leave and go home at some point. So as you say, I think it only works if there's a finite amount of work that you've got to get done in the time.
Yeah.
Or that you change the system. So you invest a bit, you employ more people, and you just, you know, you rota them on particular days so that somebody is always covering the work, but every single person within that is working 4 days, which shouldn't be, you know, shouldn't be impossible.
And actually, either. I mean, but the other thing is the if retention is part of the issue, if the idea of a 3-day weekend means you get better people and they don't keep leaving, because the lost opportunity cost of spending time recruiting, advertising, interviewing, onboarding, that terrible phrase and all that, that has a cost as well, which is obviously often isn't taken into account when you're looking at, you know, retention and recruitment. So moving on from the 4-day week to the state of the jobs market generally, Brits work shy? Britain is one of the least work-orientated countries in the world, with less than 1 in 4 people think their career should come first in life. That's according to a new international study. They spoke to people about work in 24 countries, found people in the UK were the least likely to say that work was important. 73% said that work was an important part of their life, compared to 96% in Italy and 94% in France, which flies in the face of the idea that we're the hardworking ones and it's all those work-shy Europeans. Well, let's speak to Anne-Elisabeth Moutet, who is a French journalist and a columnist at The Telegraph, who joins me now. Good morning.
Good morning.
So, are we wrong to think that the Brits are the hardworking ones and the French are the lazy work-shy ones?
Well, you are probably wrong to think that the French are work shy, because what we do is we make space for things in our lives, like, you know, lunches, and not, you know, it's even forbidden by law, by health and safety, to have lunch at your desk in France because of hygiene reasons, for instance. So we try and make space. But once you get at working, you know, after the strikes and everything else and the long weekends, we are actually among the most productive workers in the world, more productive than American workers, for instance, and I think more productive than German workers. So, but, you know, it's more concentrated, but they take it seriously. In terms of a poll, my feeling when I was sort of reading the long piece about it is that there are different views of this. Because when you ask for a British person, is your work the most important thing in your life? It's not a very British thing to be earnest. So they will say, oh, no, there are plenty of interesting things. Whereas the French and the Germans are going to demonstrate how serious they are about these things and how important their job is. But my experience is also that the British like their bosses better than the French do. I mean, the French hate their bosses. They caricature them at every instance. The relationship within any kind of hierarchical outfit in France, whether it is the civil service or a private company, is the boss is king. Under the boss, you've got three guys who are desperately vying for the boss's job, and all the rest are peons. And I'm almost not making this up. It's very different in terms of atmosphere.
I asked this with some trepidation, Manveen, but do you hate your boss?
I used to have a boss I hated. Oh, I don't know. I like my bosses now, but they're English.
What about you, Manveen?
Don't ask me on radio. No, I don't, thankfully. But I think you're onto something. I think the British are much less likely to admit to putting work first, because we just wouldn't, even if that's what we did. So I imagine a survey like this might suffer in terms of that. Although, like, the survey has been going on for 40 years and it does show a steady decline, which I think is really interesting. I have to say, I was shocked when I saw it, because I thought, who are these people? Everyone I know seems to work incredibly hard.
But I actually read it thinking, Matthew, this wasn't a bad thing. The idea that maybe we're getting our priorities right was probably quite good.
Well, absolutely. And I think it's to do with, there's been a shift in recent years where we're being told to live our best lives. And, you know, clearly that doesn't involve work as much anymore. So maybe it's, you know, there's a new generation of people who are valuing other things such as family, home time, other things other than work. And I have to say, I was very surprised by the story, because it's not at all how I perceive all these countries to be. Yeah. But if it's true, it's really, really fascinating that there is a kind of shift. And maybe people are wanting to do jobs that they find more fulfilling and more interesting. So, but the idea that your work doesn't come first, I find that very, very surprising.
And I wonder if it is generational, because, you know, it seems to be that millennials and then generations, Gen Z, as we're supposed to call them, they seem to value work even less than generations before. And I wonder if it's, if you've grown up with your parents working very hard and not being able to put family first, maybe you sort of reprioritize and decide that that's what you're going to focus on instead. So I just thought it was really fascinating, a real sort of social change.
Yeah, absolutely. It is really interesting. I just want to pick Matthew up on using the phrase living your best life. That was dangerously close. Dangerously close to sort of live, laugh, love, the sort of thing that's get you banned from coming back. But we'll let you off. Anne-Elizabeth Moutet, thanks very much for joining us this morning. Actually, before I let you go, Matthew and Manveen, we are opening the doors to the Museum of Political Fiascos tomorrow. Yeah, we've been scouring the globe for the treasures that can go in the museum. We've got, I think, Liz Truss's lecture, the Ed Stone, David Cameron's pasty. Matthew, what would you put in the Museum of Political Fiascos?
Well, I hope it's going to be interactive, because there's got to be a big transport section with Nicholas Holmes' quad bike and Andrew Mitchell's bicycle and maybe Boris Johnson's JCB digger. You can get into it and plough through the EU red tape and maybe get on the zip wire, hop onto the double-decker bus. I think it's got to be transport-focused.
I think we might even have a transport room. What about you, Manveen?
There'd have to be some cardboard boxes painted as buses in there as well. I think the Ed Stone is a really good one, but you mentioned the Ed Stone and pasties, and I sort of think actually anything food related to do with the Miliband. So there'd have to be a bacon sandwich and a banana. Things that kill political careers.
Matthew Bell and Manveen Rana then. Of course, you can listen to Manveen every day on the Stories of Our Times podcast. One story told in depth, wherever you get your podcasts from. Right, up next is the Times Radio Focus Group.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hi, I'm Jane Garvey.
And I'm Fee Glover.
Off Air with Jane and Fee is going live.
We are taking to the stage at the amazing Crucible Theatre in Sheffield on Friday, the 31st of May.
It'll be a night full of surprises. We'll have a special guest, we'll involve you in the audience, and we'll embarrass ourselves. You really won't want to miss it.
Well, the surprise is we don't yet know what's in it, so it genuinely is a night of surprises.
Well, you've surprised me already. It's not just us. Our live show is part of an exciting new podcast festival called Crosswires, which is taking place in some really amazing venues across Sheffield from the 31st of May to the 2nd of June.
So other podcasters that you'll be able to see include Katie Price, Catherine Ryan, Ramesh Ranganathan and the original Adam Buxton. But there's also a whole host of free fringe events, family shows, surprise acts and after parties that Jane and I haven't yet been invited to.
I'm sure it's only a matter of time. Head to crosswires.live for tickets and more information.
Here's a question for the marketers listening. Want to find that perfect customer beyond the world of scrolling, swiping, and searching? Here's a secret to make sparks fly. Smooth talking with podcast ads. With Acast, you can reach millions of listeners who'll be hanging on your every word. On the train to work, in the gym, or waiting in line for coffee. Start up the conversation with podcast listeners anywhere and everywhere. And they're looking for love. 60% of listeners have a higher trust in brands they've met on podcasts compared to social. Get closer to your audience. Make podcast ads with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.
You're listening to the Red Box Podcast. Now it's time for this.
The Big Thing on Times Radio.
Every month here on Times Radio, we convene a focus group of voters to assess how the government is getting on and see what matters to people outside the Westminster bubble. The focus group was run by James Johnson from JL Partners, former number 10 pollster, and joins me now. Hi, James.
Morning.
James, let's start first of all. Who are these people? Where are they from? How do we choose them? And why is a focus group different to a poll?
Absolutely. So we work with an independent market research agency to find people according to a particular specification. And the people we were looking for this month were a mix of Labour and Conservative voters in 2019 who are now undecided how they would vote. And they were from three key constituencies pivotal to the next election: Finchley and Golders Green, Wakefield, and Hastings and Rye. And the big caveat that we always make, I'm sure people could repeat it verbatim now, Matt, is that it is different from a poll in that we're not sitting here and saying this is what swing voters across the country definitively think. It's only eight people or so. Polls are of 2,000 people. They're much more likely to be nationally representative. Focus groups are there to dig a bit deeper to find out what might be informing those polls, which, of course, currently show Labour significantly ahead of the Conservatives.
And it's a reminder that then when, you know, although they said they were undecided, when you sort of pressed them on it, some clearly come down one side or the other. And it's a reminder that therefore someone who might tell a pollster, I'll probably vote Labour at the next election, underneath that, they might have doubts or concerns or, you know, getting a sense of are they enthusiastically doing that or otherwise is important. Before we even got going, James, we've had a message from someone, another focus group of people who can't make their minds up. Not the sort of thing we should be taking any notice of. Can we have a focus group of people who can make decisions about what they think? So just address that point. Why are we going for undecideds and not people who are definitely going to vote Conservative or Labour?
Well, the first thing is that that's a big chunk of the electorate. People are not following the ins and outs of politics all the time. A lot of them even admitted on our focus group that they weren't very informed at all. And actually, they wait until the election day itself to or the election campaign itself to think about it. Second thing is that in the dynamics of a specific election, the don't knows are really, really important. About one fifth of people who voted Conservative in 2019 now say they don't know how they would vote. And that is going to be a really important swing group. Of course, the direct switchers, those who say Conservative in 2019 and now Labour, matter too. And in our last focus group, we spoke to them. But this don't know group is actually larger. So absolutely pivotal which way they fall come a general election.
Fine. That is all the background. Let's get on with it then. And we should start with the big sort of political story of the week. The question of concrete, this rack, aerated concrete, which has meant that some buildings are at risk of collapse. More than 40 schools across England couldn't start as normal this week after finding rack concrete. Others are still waiting to be checked. Same is happening in Wales and Scotland too. But specifically on the question of, it's essentially around the schools because that was the sort of the big story a couple of days when we did this. James, you asked them whether they held the government responsible.
I don't think at all. I think he has nothing actually to do with it.
Not all. It weren't relevant to the decision at the time to put it in.
I think it was used in the 1950s as well. So I think it goes back quite a way.
Children's education is being affected and lives are potentially at risk right now. And Rishi Sunak does have to take some blame because a problem was presented to him and he chose to ignore it.
James, what a corrective to the media and, dare I say, Twitter discourse about this story.
Yeah, look, it really hinged on how clued up people were about the story. Those who had heard about Rishi Sunak's previous decision as a chancellor, like that lady you heard at the end there, did blame Rishi Sunak. But again, it is that corrective. People are not following in the detail that perhaps the press and you know, a lot of the sort of Twitter commentariat have been over the last few days. And most people have seen this story. They've got a sense that it was around for a long time beforehand. And although they're very frustrated about it and they want it fixed ASAP and they're worried about it, they're not necessarily blaming the Conservative government and Rishi Sunak.
It's really interesting that the people are able to sort of separate those things out. And maybe, I mean, this was, what, Tuesday night? Maybe, you know, that shows a challenge for Labour in terms of trying to pin it on the Conservatives. We should talk about Education Secretary Gillian Keegan in particular. And some of them had heard about her in a sweary outburst where she was caught on camera saying she'd done an effing good job while others had sat on their arses. Big question, this. Did they mind having a cabinet minister who swore?
I'm not that interested about a person swearing.
Increasingly, I'm finding swearing coming into everyday parlance. And for me, it's not acceptable. And I'm very disappointed that a member of the government has sworn in public.
We shouldn't really expect politicians to swear.
I actually don't agree. I find they are still human, and sometimes politicians just seem like robots. And I think there's worse things to worry about than if she said ass or whatever she said.
I agree.
James, slight generational split in this, I think. You know, the slightly older lady there said she didn't want swearing creeping into everything. But really, really interesting, which is what's got so great about the folks, a really, really interesting bit of analysis that we complain all the time about politicians being like robots. And then they show that they are, in fact, human. And when they're frustrated, they might swear, actually thinking they're not on camera anymore. And then we go, oh, it's terrible. It's terrible. Turns out she's a human being.
Yeah, absolutely. Look, I don't think Gillian Keegan's going to get a load of bonus from that, because voters do want authenticity, but they also want competence. And clearly, I don't think people's views on the government's competence on this issue are particularly good. But it does speak to that. I thought what was really interesting about it is that they hadn't actually, from the clip, picked up on what a lot of people have commented on, the gratitude point, the sneering, are they sneering at us? Are they, asking more of the voters than they deserve? It was the swearing that dominated. And it is just, again, that example that people are getting this information from the smallest snippets. And for most people, they didn't see a, whole portrait and insight into a cabinet minister. They saw swearing, and that's how they responded to it.
Well, let's, on that question then, of this sort of gratitude, why am I not being thanked for doing a good job? This is what the focus group had to say about that question. Does anybody ever say, well done, you've done a good job?
My regional manager don't come to me and go, you've done exactly what you're supposed to do at work today. But they'll come to me like, look, this is an issue, we need to talk about it, and gets flagged up.
They get paid a salary, that's their gratitude, right?
As a society, we don't catch people doing things right. We catch people doing things wrong.
Really smart analysis, James.
Yeah. And this is when we prompted for that gratitude question. And yeah, I love that regional manager point. It's basically spot on, I think. I think we probably would all agree with that in life. It might be unfair, but everybody faces that problem.
Yeah, you don't go just get a pat on the head for just doing your job, unless you're getting a knighthood for being an actor, in which case that's completely fine. But let's move on and look at the broader political picture now. And you asked the focus group how they thought generally the government was doing.
Abysmal. I'm a Conservative voter, and I really am ashamed of what they've been doing.
I'm a Conservative voter, but I would say they're struggling. I feel like anything they'll do will be wrong.
The leader of the country is a finance man, and he's managed to mess all the finances up.
The expression I would use is out of touch.
Rishi Sunak, I used to think that he was the man for the job, but now I think that he is so out of touch, he just has no idea what's going on.
I mean, James, this is bad, isn't it? A Conservative voter saying they're ashamed by what they've been doing.
Absolutely. I mean, there were some really brutal quotes in there. There's this sense from voters that, and it's grown over the last few months, that the government comes up with a solution to something, it doesn't quite work. They go in for something else, it doesn't quite work again. We heard Keir Starmer yesterday at PMQs refer to them as the cowboys. The cowboys are in charge. They're just rubbishy sort of solutions that don't quite work. And I expect Labour may well have picked that up from a focus group, because people are describing the government in those terms. They have these solutions. They don't quite work. They try another, and it's still a shambles. And that's certainly cutting through to people in a way that perhaps it wasn't about 6 months or so ago.
And then you asked them, and this is always a sort of dabbing exercise, actually, for all party leaders. Never mind the government in general. Can they sum up Rishi Sunak in one word?
Overrated.
Business-led.
Incompetent.
Out of touch.
Billionaire just kind of sums it all up.
Disappointment.
Hopeless.
And on it went, James. They talked about being having a silver spoon in his mouth, about being rich and out of touch. And that just seems to have been, he's been Prime Minister for almost a year now, and that seems to have crystallised in people's minds.
Brutal. And I think it's worth saying even more brutal than when we did the Labour switchers group. Certainly, I think the worst we've heard in these focus groups so far. One of the most interesting ones was a lady who voted Conservative in 2019, as with others in the group, now undecided. And she said, Rishi Sunak, he's very capitalist. He only thinks about the economy. Now, this same lady was not sort of, you know, chomping at the bit for socialism, but she was using that word capitalist to mean he's only interested in the money. He's this sort of billionaire. And some people, one person even compared him to Boris Johnson. They said Boris Johnson is the puppet, whereas Rishi Sunak is more smart. He knows what he's doing. The problem for Rishi Sunak is that some of these voters think he's channeling that intelligence and channeling that focus to enrich himself rather than people more broadly. And when voters make that assumption about someone's background, that becomes really difficult for a politician to turn around, however unfair it might be.
And you asked them exactly how they thought he came across when he appeared on TV.
He's so short.
He's a weasel. Mm. Not saying I'm Brad Pitt, but, you know, he's this small, like, little... He's just like a weasel. Like, he's not... I don't know how we can be expected to be taken serious.
He comes across very smooth.
Yeah, I would think he's slick. You'd want him to work for you.
I'd say polished.
He comes across as disingenuous. It's not as much what he says, it's his body language and his facial expressions.
Blimey, O'Reilly. Then you asked them, we'll come to the weasel in a minute, but just to sort of lump all this in, you asked them to give the government a grade from A to F.
D, they've abandoned the young people and people in need.
F, because there's too many problems.
C, just enough to get by.
E, not enough attention to the National Health Service and education.
E.
F, I don't think they follow through on any of their promises.
E, that they've got too many things that they need to start.
D, F, C, E, E, F. This is getting worse, James, week to week.
Yeah, look, this is not a government surging towards re-election, is it? I think if this doesn't change, it is also not a government that's even remotely competitive coming election. Very sort of negative. And the interesting thing is on that question of how Rishi Sunak comes across, we've asked that a few times over the last few months. And actually, even when media commentariat were saying, oh, perhaps Rishi Sunak's a bit wooden, perhaps Rishi Sunak's a bit patronising, actually, voters, if you remember, were always sort of saying, oh, he's quite strong, he's quite, you know, he's quite professional, he comes across as quite intelligent. That also was different in this focus group. Let's see whether it's a pattern, but people becoming a lot more negative. And I mean, you heard it there as that man, you know, very modestly said he himself is no Brad Pitt, but he thought that Rishi Sunak came across as a weasel. And when voters are using terms like that, it's not great news, is it, Matt?
If there's one glimmer of good hope, though, a glimmer of hope for Rishi Sunak, it was when you asked them, right, you don't think the government's doing very well, you don't think much of Rishi Sunak, is there anyone else who could do any better?
We don't know if anyone else could do better or worse, but the times we're in are challenging for any government. It's a caught between a rock and a hard place. They try and be harsh on immigration and bring the numbers down, but then someone says, no, that's racist, that's against human rights, it goes to court and gets shot down, and they just can't win either way.
We're struggling with the NHS, struggling with the housing. There's like too many things on the plate, and I think anyone who picks up that plate is going to be overwhelmed as well.
I do think that this government in particular has a lack of empathy and is greatly detached from the common man and woman.
What can number 10 make from that, Josh?
Well, I think it shows that we're headed for a very bleak election campaign next year, because the silver lining for the Conservatives is basically that the voters don't think anybody else can do any better.
Yeah.
And it's interesting because we get a lot of this talk from Labour, for example, but saying, you know, Britain is broken. Actually, if you say Britain is broken to voters, they take that to mean that the whole system is bust. You know, politicians can't fix these things. They're out of their control. And I think there was a report this week that Keir Starmer is looking to address this with shadow cabinet. Apparently a presentation happened with his reshuffled cabinet about how to energise these voters who perhaps are feeling that politicians are powerless. But that is a big thing to turn around. And, you know, you can see a very negative, almost quite dark campaign where perhaps the Conservatives are saying, you've got to stick with us because no one else can do it better.
So, James, let's turn now to what the group make of Keir Starmer. We've heard, you know, they're not big fans of Rishi Sunak and the Conservative government. What do they think of Keir Starmer?
I would like to like him, but I would say duplicitous. He was working with Corbyn and he backed Corbyn. And now he's the leader of the Labour Party and he's just turned around on what he backed.
Unsure.
I'd agree with duplicitous.
Unsure. Inactive.
I'm just not sure about him. I want to like him. But there's just something there. I think it's just because maybe he's from the Labour Party. I'm still unsure on who I'd vote for next, but I feel like Labour isn't what we need next. I think we need to get our economy back and Labour's not going to do that.
Yeah, I don't think Labour as a party are probably the right people to get us out of this. But if he was a Tory, maybe.
So, James, not a ringing endorsement of Keir Starmer.
No, and when we were doing the group, my other co-founder, Dr. Tom Lubbock, said it's a bit of a handbrake turn. You know, they're very critical of the Conservatives and Rishi Sunak, but then this thought of Labour is still concerning. Now, for most, actually, as I'm sure we'll hear, it wasn't enough to stop them from considering voting Labour. But there are clearly some deep concerns, especially on the economy, on Starmer's leadership itself. Couple of other people mentioned immigration, crime. So, yeah, it's, again, we say it every time, but, you know, this is not Blair riding to victory in the 90s. There are still a lot of concerns about Keir Starmer and the wider Labour brand that will be deployed, I'm sure, by the Conservatives and other parties come the next election.
So let's try and sort of unpick a bit of that then. That, you know, there's openness to Labour, more being pushed away by the Tories. But what are those concerns? There's still none sure, it seems, in part about Labour and the economy. So let's just dig a bit deeper into that.
I feel like the Labour Party has an awful reputation, especially if he was linked to Jeremy Corbyn. That's like a complete no-no. I think they're going to just ruin the economy. Wait until Labour gets in, it'll be worse.
Yeah, it will be worse. They kind of tanked the economy. Didn't Gordon Brown sell off all the gold, and if I remember rightly?
Not that I'm not going to run out and vote Labour, but I don't really see how it could get any worse.
I agree.
You know, we say it can't get any worse, but it could get worse.
Yeah.
If the wrong people got into power, I mean, everything could double.
We're a long way from things can only get better, James. Having a debate about whether or not things could get worse.
Indeed. And again, you can see that sort of, you know, negative, quite, you know, bleak campaign taking shape off the back of these comments. I could almost feel from here, Matt, the anger at some of our listeners at the Gordon Brown gold comment.
Oh, I found it very nostalgic, James. It took me way, way back to the days of when it's even sort of pre 2010. That this idea that Gordon Brown sold the gold. I mean, it was endless Daily Mail front pages about a decade.
It was, and it's worth saying that it's not the only time it came up. I mean, you know, I've heard it in other focus groups. Gordon Brown's management of the economy does still come up, and that has clearly created a view that Labour are not good on the economy. Immigration, crime, Keir Starmer's positions on things. You know, is he going to take a strong position? So look, I'm not suggesting for a moment that these are terminal issues for Labour. With the current frustration at the Conservatives and Rishi Sunak, these are not necessarily enough to block them. But clearly, come a campaign, those polls are going to get more competitive because we're going to see those attacks come out and potentially start to change some voters' minds.
Just for nerds who aren't familiar with the gold issue, Gordon Brown, between 1999 and 2002, sold off 395 tonnes of the UK's gold, raising $3.5 billion. It was then found that if in 2009 he'd hung on to the gold and sold it then, he'd have raised $10.5 billion, $7 billion difference, which converted into pounds at the time would have been worth £4.7 billion. So it was basically he sold it off, thinking he was getting a good deal, and then later the price of gold went up, and if he'd hung on to it, you know, we've all done that, sold things perhaps we shouldn't have done. That's what it was all about. But I mean, this, I mean, that is properly ancient. You know, this is dating back to 1999, this. But it's still one of those things which just lodges in people's minds. Right, let's move on again then. And so you tried to press them a bit. They were found by the market research company as being undecided, not sure what they would do at an election. But you tried to press them. If pushed, if they had to vote, how would they vote in an election?
I think I'd probably end up going Labour, just because I just think if I went Conservative, I'd just presume it'd fail again, and then I'd think, well, why didn't I go Labour?
Very slightly leaning Conservative, because Labour seem softer on crime, immigration and the economy. I haven't seen any plan they've put forward other than saying our government currently isn't doing well enough.
I'd go for Keir Starmer then. I feel like he's, like I said earlier, I think he's almost, he's got sort of the characteristics of a Tory, but he's just for Labour.
I think on balance, Labour, because Keir Starmer seems to be more real.
I think I would try Keir Starmer, even though I think he's duplicitous. He's less duplicitous than Rishi Sunak.
I'd go for Conservative because I couldn't have Labour. Not because of Rishi, not because of Starmer. I just can't. I think Labour will just do an awful job.
Keir Starmer, though I don't really think he stands for much. He seems to not really take any stance on anything. At least he's not Jeremy Corbyn.
Jeremy Corbyn, ring the bell for that one as well, James. Interesting. So here's a bit of an analysis I want to sort of put to you, James. Off the back of that, Mike has just texted in. So Labour's 20-point lead looks wide but shallow. Beyond the rhetoric on 13 years of Tory mismanagement and it's time for change, what are you left with? A change to what and how, given the state of the economy and the public finances? Say what you like about Tony Blair, but he did sell his vision for Britain more effectively than Keir Starmer does. We could all do with a dose of that 90s optimism now, I feel. Difficult to offer that optimism. You haven't got any money to spend it on, though, James.
Yeah, absolutely. But I think Mike's largely spot on there, which is there is that lack of enthusiasm. There is that need for a positive vision. As you heard there, these voters are, you know, three of them broke for Labour, three for the Conservatives. Four broke for Labour, three for the Conservatives, one for the Lib Dems. The Keir Starmer has them sort of interested, but he's not got them locked in. And, you know, whether it's a sort of a reform picture that he goes for, or whether it's something else a bit more bold, he needs to create some sort of enthusiasm and to lock them in. Or if not that, at least some kind of sense of seriousness and strength that they can back him as a leader on.
That's all we've got time for on today's focus group. You can listen back to previous focus groups to see how public opinion has shifted during the last few months. Just search Times Radio Focus Group wherever you are listening to this podcast. I will have another one next month. But for now, from me, Matt Jolly, it's goodbye.
Hey, marketers, advertisers, and business owners. Find yourself chatting up the same audience in the same places, using the same old lines? Maybe it's time to podcast the net further to catch your next customer. With Acast, there's plenty of fish in the sea with more than 100,000 podcasts and millions of listeners. So there's a perfect match for every business. Use our ad platform to cast your net, then narrow down using targeting such as demographic, show categories, audience segments, and more. Find your match, then reel them in. Advertise on more than 100,000 podcasts with Acast. Head to go.acast.com/closer to get started.